You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. It's Thanksgiving, so we're talking turkey with sweet potato casserole, stuffing, cranberry sauce, and pecan pie. But we're also discovering some surprising truths about this holiday.
As it turns out, roasted turkeys are actually nowhere near the original Thanksgiving tables. In fact, most of the foods we eat for Thanksgiving today weren't eaten in Plymouth.
And you know, a lot of the dishes came about, well, because of the products that were on the shelves and the marketing that told us this is the product we should use.
Every once in a while, though, the consumer creates the food trend. Care to top the turducken, anyone?
I've got to give credit to this fellow that said, this is the best pile of meat I've ever had, and then said, but if you added bacon...
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, everybody. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Each week, we bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life through conversations with the most inspiring women in and around the world of food. First, let's thank our sponsors, Le Cordon Bleu. If you're daydreaming about culinary school, maybe it's time to say bonjour to Le Cordon Bleu. Learn more about the legendary culinary school's most prestigious professional qualification, Le Grand Diplôme, by visiting cordonbleu.edu. And let's thank Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs. Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs are better than cage-free. They are bull-free. Try for yourself. To get your coupon for Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs, head to vitalfarms.com/cherrybomb. And Bob's Red Mill. Bob's Red Mill is an employee-owned company that's been offering organic, gluten-free, and stone-ground products for decades. You know with Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed food that tastes amazing. Go to bobsredmill.com and use the code CHERRYBOMB25 for 25% off your order. We have a special show for you today because I've been on the road for the Future of Food Tour. Jesse Sheehan, the author of The Vintage Baker, is filling in for me today as guest host. Just in time for Thanksgiving, Jesse sat down with Lisa Lidwinski, the founder, owner, and head baker of Sister Pie, the brilliant bake shop in Detroit. While we were in Detroit for our radio tour last week, we stopped by Sister Pie and had a slice of Lisa's cranberry crumble. It was one of the best pies I've ever had. Not too sweet, just tart enough, and with that delicious crunchy brown sugar oat cinnamon topping. The Sister Pie cookbook is out now and just happens to have a recipe for the cranberry crumble. If you need any baking ideas or just love pie, be sure to snag a copy. Thank you to Jesse Sheehan for filling in for me on this week's show. Enjoy their conversation and have a wonderful Thanksgiving. If you post any of your creations on Instagram, be sure to tag #BombSquad so we can see what you're up to. We'll be right back with Jesse Sheehan and Lisa Lidwinski after this word from Le Cordon Bleu. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and patisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there: London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin.
Hi, Hello, Bomb Squad. This is Jessie Sheehan, and I am subbing for Carrie today, and I am incredibly excited to be doing so because I love Cherry Bomb, I love Carrie, and I get to talk to this amazing guest. Her name is Lisa Ledwinski. You may know her as Sister Pie. She has written an incredible cookbook called Sister Pie, and she also has an amazing bakery in Detroit called Sister Pie. I like to think of her as kind of like an entrepreneurial baking rock star, like no joke. She's gotten incredible press for this like gorgeous, funny, and smart book. Press from the New York Times, press from like the fancy bloggers who have like a million followers, press from Cherry Bomb, et cetera, Food and Wine, Eater. It's amazing. And when you learn about her bakery, you like want to get to Detroit, like stat, or at least I'm going. Second, I'm excited because Lisa is like an incredible dancer. I mean, no joke, peeps. I'm not talking like ballet or jazz. I'm kind of talking about what you need to do, which is do a deep dive on the Sister Pie Instagram feed because the videos are amazing. I am not kidding. I loved them. And Lisa mentions in the book, I kind of read it like a little bit like obsessively, so I kind of... But anyway, Lisa mentions in the book that she was once a mime, and I see her mime in the dance. It is amazing. So anyway, I'm no joke. Also, Lisa describes herself as having a natural hustle and bustle, and I gotta say, I kind of feel like I do too, so I kind of think there's a hustle and bustle thing happening today. And finally, we both love cream cheese, and that's like one of my favorite foods, and it seems like it might be one of Lisa's. Finally, this is like a dream come true for me, because when I buy an amazing baking book, I always like, you know, bring it into bed and read it like it's like a novel. And it's really exciting to be able to have done that and like had questions and be like, what the, why'd you do that? And then now I get to sit with her and ask her. So at the end of this talk, I am going to ask Lisa all my pressing questions. Okay? Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
First thing I wanted to talk to you about is sort of like the beginning, like Sister Pie. I know where the name comes from, but maybe you want to tell people. I would love to hear a little bit about childhood, only because I'm sort of really interested in two things. One, did you bake a lot? I know there's the salty cookie grandma story, but I am a baker, but I'd never baked when I was little, so I'm always curious about people's stories. And then two, I'm curious about like the kind of values that you grew up with. Like, was your family super political? Like, does your what you're kind of going after now as an adult with your bakery, and we'll talk more about that definitely, did that kind of start at home? Or was that something that you kind of came to on your own?
All right, what a way to dive in. First, I'll just start by saying that when I realized I was going to open a bakery, I thought about how I was doing it right around the fall season and that Thanksgiving seemed like a perfect time to kind of launch. And I was doing this out of my parents' kitchen in the suburbs of Detroit. And as soon as I realized that pie would be the thing I would do first, Sister Pie popped into my mind because it's a nickname that my younger sister and I started calling each other when we were in college. And it was a true term of endearment. It was like a really strong point in our relationship where I felt like I was truly the big sister and she was the younger sister and we were, and that is, you know, what we are, but we were just like in our prime for that. And so the term really meant a lot to us. And we don't call each other that much anymore because now it's taken on a whole...
It's like, what do you mean bakery?
...life of its own. But that's where it came from. And I think it makes me think a lot about my childhood. And so when I was a kid, I didn't bake that much. I mean, yeah, I made the random batch of salty cookies with my grandma. And I would bake with my mom just chocolate chip cookies and, you know, pies at Thanksgiving. But they were pretty basic recipes. And one thing I do remember was every Easter... we would make a Polish bread that my great-grandmother would make. And so that was kind of like our yearly baking tradition. But I definitely didn't grow up, you know, baking constantly. And I was more interested in watching the Food Network, actually. And so I think I had those aspirations, which kind of align with my theatrical nature. And so my family was, we were very, very close, and we still are. And my mom raised us Catholic. So we went to Catholic school, specifically all girls Catholic high school. And I really think it was, and I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore, but I really do think that when I was at that Catholic high school, it was kind of like a more, I guess you could say, liberal Catholic high school. And it was very much, it was called Mercy High School. And so the values of it were mercy, justice, option for the poor, all of these things that really stuck with me. And I was able to take these religion classes that were also based in like social justice. And that really kind of formed me. And then when I went into college and I went to kind of a liberal arts school that was also very social justice focused, I kind of carried that with me. My family grew up definitely much more politically conservative than I am. Well, I was more politically conservative when I was a child, I think because that's how I was raised. And then as soon as I kind of broke out into the world, I started singing a different tune. And now I very much do. But I think like the important thing is that some of the values that I was raised with, and I think like even just my mom, you know, hammering into my head the be kind to everyone and treat someone else like you'd want to be treated. That was like the most important thing that stuck with me. Mm-hmm. And so I think even though we disagree on things now, I know that those lessons I learned from her were so valuable and that it's helped me so much in my business.
And it's also nice to kind of hear, because I read about like that you'd gone to Catholic school. It's sort of nice to hear the opposite story. You know, so many people, like including my husband, have stories about Catholic school and this and that. And it's sort of nice to hear about it that actually fed you in a really kind of positive way as a grown-up. I kind of love that. It's like unique.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? I had some amazing teachers in all of the Catholic schools I went to, from grade school to high school, just people who like have really shaped me and stuck with me. And even the other week I was doing a pop-up with another woman who went to my Catholic grade school, and our eighth grade teacher showed up and our history teacher and the librarian, and it was just really incredible. So yeah.
And then I know when you actually did go to college, you went to pursue directing, or?
I did theater in high school, and then I went to Kalamazoo College in Kalamazoo, Michigan. It's a very small school, about 1,300 kids, and I was a theater arts major.
Yeah.
So I was kind of dabbling in everything. I did a lot of acting, and then as I kind of grew older at the school, I started to take a real interest in directing, and I think a big part of that was that my identity as a feminist was becoming so much a part of me during those college years, and it seemed like a great way to be able to kind of communicate what I was feeling and what I thought needed to go out into the world. And I was also really inspired by this really great British playwright, Carol Churchill. And also I think I was really interested in creating a certain type of rehearsal space and a certain type of energy just behind putting on a production. So it feels like no surprise that I then just turned that into being a business owner.
I was going to say that it's not so different, you know, I actually never directed. I was in plays, but not directing them. But it's that same thing of you're creating something, right? And you get a lot from your book, and we'll get to this a little bit more in a bit, but about the kind of community that you're creating. So was it sort of directing that brought you to New York?
Yeah. And I was definitely into improv as well. I was kind of into all of it. I decided to move to New York after college to pursue directing. I wanted to start an all-female theater company. And as soon as I moved here, I think I was, you know, I was like 22. Yeah. To become a director is like so different than even trying to become an actor, because an actor, you at least have the structure of auditions to go on. Right. But with directing, you have to be a go-getter, like in the ultimate way. And I was, you know, just learning how to pay bills on my own. So I wasn't quite ready for that. And in the meantime, I was just getting really distracted and interested by all of the delicious food in New York, not to mention that it was like around the time when food blogs were really just like hitting the universe, and I was, you know, obsessively reading them. And so I was developing this whole other passion for myself. And then I kind of threw theater to the side a little bit. And it was kind of cool because one of my first kind of theater gigs when I was here was that I was an assistant director to a guy named Terry Kinney. He was one of the original founders of Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago. So I worked with him a little bit, and then I ended up being a nanny for his children in Park Slope. And so that was like a big gig for me for 4 years when I was living here. And it was really cool because, I mean, being a nanny is a wonderful job. You get to spend time with kids and like talk about family style community in the workplace. It's like right there. But it also like afforded me the opportunity to pursue kind of whatever I wanted to on the side. And what that ended up being was a cooking show that I filmed in my apartment called Funny Side Up. I did about 100 episodes of it, and it was mostly during the time that I was a nanny.
I've watched several of them.
Oh, boy.
As many as I could find.
Yeah, I've made many of them private now.
I think I found them on the site. Did I, on the Sister Pie site, maybe?
Oh, yeah, there are a few. On video. Yeah, my select favorites.
Note to listeners, please look at them. They are awesome.
Oh, my gosh.
They are. They're so, it's just, whatever, it's just fun to see. It seems like you're having fun, and it was, what I also like is it was a while ago. Like, I feel like now every person has like YouTube and I do this and I've got my, I'm making cookies and I'm, but I feel like when you were doing it, it was like very like low tech in the best way with like the computer on the fridge, I think.
Yep.
So brilliant. You're like looking up. I love it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It was
I
really
wish there
fun.
Was more dancing because I really
Yeah, that was pre-dancing.
I know. And then I know you were at Milk Bar and 420 Blackbirds, like two iconic New York City places. And shout out to Emily from 420, who I adore. And you would, What one thing I liked reading about was staff enrichment at Milk Bar. Why don't you describe what you meant when you wrote about staff enrichment?
Sure. As soon as I started working at Milk Bar, especially back in the kitchen, I felt like an instant sense of community there. And I really liked everyone that I worked with. And I think I was just craving something outside of showing up to work every day and, you know, doing the list, which was, you know, extremely interesting and kind of fun and difficult on its own, but I was just interested in like doing a little more.
Yeah.
So I started leading group stretches, which sounds so silly and simple, but I like asked permission to do it. And so we got to spend like the first 5 minutes of the day doing some stretches and kind of talking to each other. And I think I was really wanting to like foster that opportunity where people could just kind of check in and see how things were going. And then I also was really interested in just like organizing cookie swaps and, you know, field trips or whatever. And so I was just like kind of bringing those things to the table, which I think when I was starting to do that and everyone around me was kind of like, wow, like, I can't believe you're interested in like, you know, spearheading this stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's when I started to get that little glimmer of maybe there's something here that speaks to what I want to do.
Totally. And then the 420 thing was more like a summer before you went back to...
Yeah, I was just looking for a little extra cash.
Something.
I knew some people who had worked there, so I kind of had an in. And I worked like a day or two a week for a summer, which was wonderful because Emily and Melissa were so welcoming and so sweet. And they basically put me to work making pie dough and rolling out pie dough for the days that I was there. And I was doing it like over and over again, and so it was such a great way to like just get
that
practice in. And to also see, you know, Milk Bar and 420 were like so different, like on the scale of scale, I guess. You know, at that point, 420, it just was still like the one storefront, and they had just started, I think they were still just renting space in a commissary kitchen, so they didn't have their big commissary kitchen. So it was cool to kind of see what it was like to have this like sister-owned business operating in a pretty small way.
And then, of course, after that-ish, you went back to Detroit. And can you kind of talk about, I know you worked maybe from your parents' house, maybe in a wholesale kitchen kind of, before you had your actual brick and mortar. And then also, will you tell the listeners about the dance party and raising money for you?
So I moved from New York to Detroit in September of 2012 with the intention of opening Sister Pie. It was kind of like a revelation that I had that I wanted to open a business. And I think I'll just speak a little bit to why, because I think it's kind of important to the story, which is that I was so satisfied here and so fed in terms of like creativity and delicious food and learning how to hustle. But I think there was like something really missing from my contribution to it. And I wasn't sure what that would be. And I considered for, you know, a tiny second, would I ever open a business here? But it just felt not right for me. It felt like I wasn't, there was some other reason that I wanted to open a business, and it just didn't seem like New York was the right fit. I went on a trip to San Francisco, and I visited these cooperative bakeries and these employee-owned bakeries. And then I also was able to do an internship in Detroit while I was working at Milk Bar. David Chang offered like an in-house internship, which was really like a paid internship that you could go visit anywhere. I happened to just choose the place I was from, which, you know, I could have gone to like Denmark probably, but I chose Michigan.
Paris.
But it was really wonderful because I got to spend a week at Zingerman's Bakehouse.
Awesome.
And then at a place called Avalon International Breads in Detroit, both of which had triple bottom line missions.
Yes.
Which was the commitment to people, planet, and profit. And I hadn't really really experienced that much before. And when I realized that that was like built into their businesses in such a strong way, that was like the missing piece. So kind of like going to San Francisco, being in Detroit, I realized, okay, this is the type of business that I want to run. I want to do it here in Detroit because it's close to where I'm from. And that was it for me. So yeah. I moved back. I moved in with my parents. I only had my security deposit, you know, in my bank account. And so they very wonderfully let me move into my childhood bedroom, furiously test recipes in their kitchen. I like camped out in their basement, like writing up newsletters and all these things. And so I did that for about a year. And then I moved into a shared commercial kitchen in Detroit proper, got a license. And so I was able to start having wholesale accounts, and I got an employee, and we were able to just like grow little by little. And that's when the dance breaks started happening. The dance breaks just happened one day in the kitchen. I was dancing to a song. Angie, who was my first employee, decided to record it, and we posted it on Instagram, and people seemed to like it. So we just kept doing it over and over again, and it was such a fun way for us to release energy, kind of making me think about the stretches that we did at Milk Bar, you know, just like, let's shake things up, literally.
I remember back in the day when I worked at a bakery, I live in Brooklyn in Red Hook, called Baked, and when I first worked there, we would do kind of, I don't know what about a bakery like makes that, I mean, probably not everywhere, but you're having fun, but you're so busy, and all of a sudden we would just break out. It wasn't even dances, and back then I don't think anybody could have recorded it, but like we do crazy, like we just get our bodies in crazy positions, or we would just like try to put our feet behind our heads, just like break out of whatever was normal about making cookies and do something crazy. So I can totally relate to that.
Yeah, it's like it can be such a monotonous job.
Yeah.
And so to kind of just like have a moment where you have that release feels really important. Totally. And so we would do that, and it seemed to like get people to know who we were more.
Yeah.
And so like it's almost like the dancing would bring them to the food, and then the food would keep them there.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah.
I love
and
that.
So once it came time for us to actually like build out our bakery space that we're currently in, there were a lot of creative fundraising opportunities, but my favorite one by far is our 24-hour dance party. And so we hosted it at a local record shop. It was a Indiegogo campaign, so every time someone contributed to the campaign, they got a ticket to the dance party. And the dance party promise was that I personally would dance for 24 hours straight, from 9 p.m. on a Friday to 9 p.m. on a Saturday night. And I did. And it was really hard, especially like right around 3 a.m.
Yeah.
When like people came in after like going out and getting
high-waisted
or something, and I was just like dancing by myself in this dark room. But I made it through. I made it through, and we raised $26,000 from that. Yeah,
it's so amazing, and I love the visual is also, like, I can imagine, like, lots of energy, and when it began, and then by the end, it's like, ow, my body.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, one of my friends, like, tucked me into bed that night.
Yeah.
It was really sweet.
I'm sure. Like,
yeah.
Carried you, like, over her shoulder. I also know one of the things that I think drew you home, besides all of the things that you mentioned, was also, I didn't even know this about Michigan, like, agriculturally as diverse as California, the second
most agriculturally diverse state in the whole country.
So cool and weird and like
random.
I wish I was a trivia person because I would like put that away in my little brain.
I know. It's like my favorite fact to share. Now, of course, it is sort of like significantly far behind California. No, we don't have like lemons and oranges and things, but Michigan is just such a huge state. You know, we've got the Lower Peninsula and the Upper Peninsula. It's like the number one producer of cherries in the country.
Yeah.
I think maybe even in the world. I'm not sure. But there's a wonderful array of things. And I think Eastern Market in Detroit was a place that I would visit a lot on my trips back home. And what I find so wonderful about it is that it's an opportunity for anyone in Detroit to have access to fresh produce, which is not something that you can find in every neighborhood in Detroit still. And so Eastern Market kind of exists as that. And pie, traditionally, is used to, you know, highlight fruits and vegetables mm-hmm. that farmers grow. And so it all just really made sense to me.
Totally.
Pie is communal. Pie is seasonal. Let's make pie. Totally.
Back to the triple bottom line. Can you talk about it a little bit more? Just break it down for us a little bit.
Well, I guess I will say for one thing that I think different businesses can have different definitions of the triple bottom line.
Okay.
Zingerman's is slightly different than ours. Like for Avalon, and I think like the traditional definition of a triple bottom line is that you're not just thinking about the bottom line of a business, which is the profit, but you're also thinking about people and the planet. I've also heard it described as employees economy environment. I really like describing it with people because that applies to more than just employees. Well, employees are a very important part of people. So for us, people means employees, kind of first and foremost, our neighbors, so everyone who lives in our neighborhood, and then our customers, and our farmers and our vendors, and pretty much any person that is involved, and us too, because people are what make a business run, and if people aren't happy or fulfilled or sustained or taken care of, then everything else in the business, including the profit, doesn't matter. And so we've chosen, kind of by default, I guess, because we were surrounded by people as soon as we opened the bakery, to focus on that aspect of the triple bottom line first, which feels like a risk and feels kind of scary because we don't have all of our finances like perfectly lined up. And
do most people start with money and then work their way to the other two?
I think so. I do. Yeah. I think some businesses will start with like a handbook and rules and it doesn't budge, right? And so our philosophy behind the people element is that it's constantly changing, which I think can be tough for everyone involved sometimes. It's a lot of work for us. Sometimes it feels like a lot of new stuff for employees to get used to, but it's always in the effort of getting better and better and better, and better for like every person involved in the process. And so it's also more exciting and fun to do business that way. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a lot more to think about and you feel more connected to the people who are part of Sister Pie. It's about a lot of people. And then the planet, of course, you know, food businesses specifically produce a lot of waste. And so the planet aspect is to kind of think about creative ways that you can eliminate that or at least reduce it. And so, you know, simple things are recycling and compost and make sure you're doing that. But how can you even take, you know, eliminating waste one step further? For one thing, at the bakery, we make these pie sandwich cookies and they're in the cookbook.
Yeah,
and we generate a lot of dough scraps from the different pies that we're making. And so we roll them out, bake them into cookies. And they're the scraps of dough that like we couldn't use to roll out for pie dough anymore. So it's really nice in a way to kind of make sure we're not wasting any of that precious, precious butter or any of that precious labor. And then, of course, you know, profit. A business needs money to run. And so all of the wonderful things that we want to do with our business can't happen unless we're sustainable and unless we can survive. And what's the point of having a business that lasts for 5 years and they make an impact, but then what about if they don't succeed? You know, and so all the while we have to be making decisions with the profit in mind. And so all three of those things kind of we try to make them appear in decisions and big conversations. A couple of ways that we continue with the triple bottom line mission, and specifically I think with people, is that we have these town hall meetings, as you mentioned, that happen once a month. They're voluntary and it's for the staff only. We make a meal and we usually have some wine, or sometimes we have like a pre-mixed margarita from Costco. No secrets here. So it's nothing too fancy, but you know, we have a dinner, something to kind of, you know, make it a little sweeter. And then people will gather around the table, and there's usually like a basic format, which is that we'll start by sharing some information about the business. So, you know, we might talk about profit and loss document, or we might talk about the cookbook tour, or just share some stuff that's going on and people can ask questions. And then we'll empty out a suggestion box that we have in our basement. We basically tried to create like so many ways for employees to communicate with us that there's like, because everyone has a different communication style. So you want to write it down and be anonymous? Do you want to talk about it in a check-in? Do you want to come to the town hall? Do you want to talk about it in your review? Like, there's just like a billion ways. And so the suggestion box is a great one. And it's funny because I feel like when we first introduced the suggestion box, it was full like every month. But as time has gone by, it's not as full. And I think it's a really great example of how our employees do feel like they can talk to us, you know?
Also, once you feel heard in a way, you don't have to say anything anymore in
a
funny way.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah. And I think they know and they trust that like we have these systems for them. And so... yeah, it just makes things a little better. So we talk about the suggestion box, and then we go into an open forums where they can bring up ideas for the future of the business or something that's just really annoying them, or can we move the garbage can or whatever it is. And we always come out of the meeting with something to change.
Yeah.
And it's great. And then Sister Pie It Forward is, you know, we're really interested in like, I think specifically in Detroit and in our neighborhood, you know, it's very common these days, and it's happening a lot, for white business owners to kind of move into the city, start businesses, and, you know, some people will talk about why they're doing it or talk to the neighbors about it or kind of hear people about what they want. But, you know, Detroit is, the population is 85% black, and those many people who are either business owners or just people who live in Detroit have, you know, seen Detroit through a whole heck of a lot. And so now in these past 10 years, we've seen a lot of movement and change in Detroit that some people might choose to call an uprising or a rebirth or a revitalization. And I think I take issue with revitalization as a term. And I know it's like a technical term, but like there's been life in Detroit for a very long time. And so as a white woman owning a business in Detroit who just, you know, moved from her time in Brooklyn, I take it upon myself to try and pressure myself to kind of include a lot of different people in the conversation and constantly be asking myself, how can we be a more accessible bakery? And I don't just mean that by like, you know, what we charge, but like, how can we make sure that our space looks welcoming? How can we make sure that it feels welcoming? Is it not going to be like the trendiest looking place, or even like what can we do to make sure that like a variety, a large variety of people feel like they can come in here, sit down and enjoy a slice of pie, and that maybe the pie isn't like always like the weirdest flavor ever, but it's like there's something for everyone. Sister Pie It Forward was created as an opportunity for customers to pre-purchase a slice of pie for someone else. So that can be someone in need, you know, someone who can't afford the slice of pie or is hungry. It can be for someone who's never had a slice of sweet beet pie before and really doesn't want to spend $4.24 on it. And so if it's paid for by someone else, that's great. And that like brings them into the shop. Or if like someone forgot their wallet at home or didn't have the exact change, like it's just always there. And I try to really encourage the employees to not have there be any sort of like prerequisite for whoever wants to take the slice. Mm-hmm. It should just be like available for everyone.
Yep.
And then we have a 15% neighborhood discount. And so I think we're just always trying to think of ways to make our businesses open and welcoming to people from everywhere.
I wanted to talk about Detroit just briefly, and then I want to talk about pie. In terms of Detroit, I was struck with something, which you sort of already have touched on, but something in your epilogue about how it's been advertised as a blank slate for creatives to roam freely. And I feel like in my own way, even though I've never been there, I'm probably guilty of that, of thinking of Detroit, like, oh my God, I gotta go to Detroit.
Oh yeah.
And I think that just you unpacked it a little bit, but can you just talk more about like why does that happen? Why do we New Yorkers sit here and think like Detroit? And then what's it really like?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is about the way we talk about it and the words that we use to talk about it and how much value and importance the words have. I think that I too was guilty before I moved to Detroit of thinking of it as a place of opportunity for me, right? And I think that's what a lot of people think. Like the narrative was and still is to an extent, money is going back into Detroit. Buildings are getting repaired and people are investing in it. And so you should come to Detroit and you should start your business there. Or you should do something artistic there because there's lots of space.
Right.
And there's not a lot of great systems in place. So there's a lot of opportunity for people with ideas to kind of bring them. And so I think what gets lost in that is the fact that there are people who have been living there this whole time. They have their own needs, they have their own desires, they have their own opinions about what should come to Detroit, what they need, what they haven't had for the past 40 years, probably longer, and where is the money going, and how are we being really responsible and thoughtful about where that money's going? Mm-hmm. And so it's easy for, you know, a handful of white men with money to say, yeah, well, I think we should develop this and do that, and everyone can applaud them, and that's great, but it's not really great. Because how are we ever going to transfer power if there isn't equity? And I think Detroit is just such a clear example of the inequity in our country. And so I'm interested in kind of like attacking that and thinking about that and hoping to be a voice for that. Because even as like a white woman of privilege, I can't meet a single developer or person or landlord who is a woman even, you know? So like, I'm already at a disadvantage myself, so I can't imagine what it feels like to be a young black person growing up in Detroit who wants to start a business and doesn't necessarily have the capital to do it. You know, so like I moved to Detroit and instantly I was granted a lot of like actually granted like money, and you know, people supported me and helped me, and I'm so grateful for those people, and they were all really wonderful and so welcoming to my business. but and like the people who come to visit us from outside of Detroit, you know, sometimes it feels like, well, I'm this white woman running this business in Detroit, so it's safe to come to my business, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I've taken it, like, we've talked about that a lot at Sister Pie and what that means, and it's been like a very difficult and challenging journey to understand what our position is in Detroit and how we can work to shift it so that it's a different narrative and that we're working to support and uplift the people around us as much as we can, whether it's like say no to interviews, you know, so that people who have run businesses in the city for a much longer time than us can get more opportunity, and how can we collaborate with people and how can we just like fight the inequity that exists. So that's like big. And so I think the advice that I give to anyone who's coming to Detroit with an idea for a business or wants to move in is talk to your neighbors. You know, ask people what they want, get to know them. Spend some time doing like a test run of your business before you kind of plant your feet. Mm-hmm. Detroit's a really interesting place to see right now, and there are a lot of trendy restaurants and there's lots of growth, but there's also deep, deep pockets of poverty and disadvantage and lack of resources for mm-hmm. people who really need them. And so it's a complicated place to be, a complicated place to talk about, and I don't even feel like I have the full vocabulary to do it.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Jesse Sheehan and Sister Pie's Lisa Lidwinski after a word from our sponsors. Does this happen to you? You need a dozen eggs. You go to the supermarket, you head to the egg section, and you are so confused by what you find there, you freeze. You want nice eggs on hand because maybe you want a cheese and herb omelet for dinner, or you want to poach an egg to slip on your avocado toast, and you know quality eggs make a big difference. And you're a decent person, so it's important the chickens have a good life. But as you stand there, you think to yourself, I have no idea what all these words on the egg cartons mean. So you shrug, pick one, and continue shopping. Stop right there. You are a busy lady. You don't need this bull in your life. You need bull free eggs, which is where Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs come in. Their pasture-raised hens roam outside in 108 square feet of space per hen. Those cage-free hens, they never go outside. I tasted the difference once I tried Vital Farms eggs. Try for yourself. To get your coupon for Vital Farms pasture-raised eggs, head to vitalfarms.com/cherrybomb. It's time for the Bob's Red Mill Minute. With Thanksgiving just a few days away, we at Cherry Bomb understand how much decision-making you need to do when it comes to this food-filled holiday. To brine or not to brine? How will you fit all the extra seats at your dining room table? And of course, there's the question of dessert. Do you want classic pumpkin pie, or is it time to try something totally new? Our suggestion? Take a literal page out of Lisa Lidwinski's new cookbook, Sister Pie, and make her cranberry crumble pie. Tart like your favorite cranberry sauce, and buttery like your favorite dinner roll, this pie really is Thanksgiving in a slice. With an all-butter pie dough, a rolled oat crumble topping, and cranberry orange compote, this is the perfect pie for those of us who don't like our desserts too sweet. And as I mentioned, I got to try a slice of this pie at Lisa's shop, Sister Pie, in Detroit last week, and let me tell you, it was unreal. When you're making your shopping list for Thanksgiving, don't forget to check out Bob's Red Mill for any organic flours, starches, and oats you might need. For the cranberry crumble pie, you're going to need Bob's Red Mill rolled oats, all-purpose flour, and tapioca flour. If you're shopping online, go to bobsredmill.com and use the code CHERRYBOMB25 for 25% off your order. You know, with Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed food that tastes amazing. And we're back with guest host Jesse Sheehan and Sister Pie's Lisa Lidwinski.
We're closing in on Thanksgiving. I'm just wondering, does it get super crazy for you right now? Like, do you guys close for a day? Did I see that on Instagram or something?
We close the Monday before Thanksgiving. So, yeah, the Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Well, actually, but, like, we're in the bakery working on Monday, but we can't deal with customers that day. And no, who's coming to the bakery on Monday? Yeah. Like, everyone's about the pie, like, bringing home a pie, and no one wants to get a pie on Monday when they can get it on Tuesday or Wednesday.
Totally.
So, yeah, we do close. It's pretty hectic. We make 1,000 pies. Which is the same number we made last year. And so we just thought, well, we should probably give that a try one more time before we increase it.
Yeah.
And it's like there's a lot of prep in advance.
Yeah.
Making as much dough as we can, making like squash purees and cranberry compote and freezing a lot of stuff. But then it's really just go time that week and everyone is all in. And it's like such a beautiful time to be at the bakery because we're all working our asses off. But, you know, we're supporting each other. We have like a sandwich bar that we put out and... Everyone, there's just like, it feels like you're watching like this machine of women who like each other and are listening to 90s R&B and just making pie. And it's a really fun thing to experience. Yeah. And you can feel it when the customers line up and come in. And that first moment, like on Wednesday morning, when there's been a line out the door for, you know, like people got there at like 6 a.m. to wait and we open at 8. And the people in the bakery are all wrapped around our big table and we're all in the back. And it's just like, I get chills thinking about it. That's like my favorite moment of the year.
It sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. I wanted to ask you all of my nerdy baking questions.
I love it.
That I just like going on in my mind. The cream cheese on the crust.
Yeah.
Love that. So is that like soggy bottom, like removal of soggy bottom if you put cream cheese on the bottom of your crust?
Totally. Yeah. I don't know when that popped into my head. I think I like probably thought about how like different pies have like ganache on the bottom or like different things on the bottom.
Egg,
and I was
brushing egg white.
Or like just putting flour and sugar on the bottom.
Totally. Or breadcrumbs, right?
Sure.
Yeah, panko, I think I've seen people do.
And I just always had cream cheese on hand and I thought, well, this is like an easy enough thing to just like spread and make a thin layer of. And you're not really thinking about the fact that it's cream cheese. It's just there. And we blind bake almost all of our crusts except for our double crusted pies. And so it's kind of like a almost fully baked crust, and then it's really easy to spread this cream cheese on it, and it does help keep the crust nice and flaky and crisp.
I love it, and I promise if I ever use it, I will be giving you lots of props.
Oh, gosh.
I also love this, that you put, like, just chunks of cream cheese into muffins and coffee cake.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I love you.
The more the better.
I'll eat cream cheese, like, I just want some cream cheese. Like, I don't even have to have anything.
talking to someone who grew up with the cream cheese sandwich in the lunchbox. That was like my number one request. It was just like white bread, cream cheese.
Love that.
I don't know where I came up with that or if it was just like my mom's suggestion, but I've always loved cream cheese. And I remember actually going to a bakery in Brooklyn called Blue Sky.
Yeah.
They have muffins.
Yes.
And I remember they had cream cheese in them. And so that always stuck with me because I just really, I think some of them did at least. I think like it was maybe like a sweetened cream cheese.
Yeah.
And even like going back to my childhood, like cheese Danish, like all of that was always like my favorite kind of pastry to have. And so with the muffins and the coffee cake, it's like the more cream cheese, the better. It's a really nice way to add like moisture, but also like to cut the sweetness.
Yeah. Well, also what I love about it too is that when I work with cream cheese, usually as a filling, I'm always sweetening it with confectioner sugar and a little bit of salt or however I'm doing it and kind of making it looser. And I mean, the coffee cake recipe, I just love the idea of like literally peeps. You have to, the recipe in the book, which I'm hoping you're all buying if you haven't already. It's literally pieces of cream cheese just laid on. I love that.
Yeah. And we put a little bit of this sugar topping that we make, which is just equal parts turbinado and granulated. But whenever I'm training someone at the bakery on how to make the coffee cake, I'm just like, no, more cream cheese. Yeah. Like, scoop it with your fingers and dollop it on. Yeah. Like, they're putting these, like, little dainty sizes. I'm like, no, I want this entire thing covered.
Yeah, it's cream cheese.
What's better than, like, just biting into a huge chunk of cream cheese?
Sugar was my next question because I'm so struck.
I knew it.
I'm so struck by sugar because I'm, like, a big turbinado person.
Put
it on, you know, on my pies, on my cookies, on my fudge, on everything. I love it. With, like, sometimes I'll mix it with salt. So I'm getting a sweet salt thing. But talk to me about sugar. Will you tell the listeners what
it is? So sugar is a topping and a sweetener that I guess created, or at least I created the name sugar. Pretty creative. To describe what is equal parts granulated sugar and turbinado sugar, which is sometimes called raw sugar. And the reason is that with granulated sugar, when you apply it to like the top of something, you get like a really nice like glittery effect almost. And of course, it's, you know, sweetness from it. But then with turbinado sugar, you get like more of a rustic look, but also like a really nice texture when you bite into it. And so it was the combination of like the visual and the textural that was important to me.
I love that.
Thank you.
Also love that your crusts are dark, that you want people to bake their pies for a really long time, that you want people to rest your pies for a really long time. Like people don't... don't get that at all. And I know it's tough because you're like, well, how could I still be baking my pie? But you really, I think you give great directions and I hope people follow them
for
making those really beautiful, because people don't always follow directions.
Well, and it's like, you know, how many times have I baked a tester in the bakery and I've like waited 2 hours to try it, like a chess pie or something, and I'm like, it's not baked enough, it's not set. And then like the next day I have it and it's like, oh my gosh, this texture is amazing.
Yeah.
And so like learning how to be a baker and specifically learning how to be a pie baker and I think even a business owner, it's all about patience. So everything is better with time and patience. And so I hope that that's what people get from it.
I also think people think of the color of pie and they think of something kind of golden, but it's not. I think people are looking for the wrong signals when they see it baking in their oven.
Yeah.
And that really it's the color, you know, it's what I'm seeing in your book that is what makes, that's what the kind of pie that I like to, it might even look a little, you know, not black, but like it's baked around the edges.
Right.
That's actually just.
Well, and I think like we make sure that the blind baked crusts are really baked, but also a big factor in it is just that the pies aren't done until the fruit is bubbling in the very center.
Yes.
And that was something that really took me a long time to understand because you see the bubbles on the outside and you're like, there's pies in this book that will bake for 2 hours in your oven.
Can I just say I have a blackberry lime pie in my new cookbook?
Yeah.
I got the meanest Amazon review because like, I was like, it never set up. And I was like, I'm certain that it was maybe, you know, you need. I said that exact thing. I set a time. But, you know, it's not just color or time. You have to actually see physically the blackberries bubbling in the center or it will be soup.
Totally.
Greasing a pie plate. Yes? All of them? Or was that just one of the recipes I stumbled upon?
I guess I don't know if it says it on all the recipes.
Yeah.
But, okay, so kind of two things here.
Okay.
One is that the original reason for greasing the pie pans was when the fruit pies, like when the juices, like kind of bubble out, sometimes they'll fall into the pan and it will make it harder to remove. But it's still pretty hard to remove.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like how it is.
Yeah.
But what my bakers have told me is that it's a lot easier to work with the rolled out crust when you go to crimp it, when the dough sticks to the pan a little
interesting.
Bit. Because so the butter actually is both like a thing that helps lift it out, but also helps keep the raw dough in the pan.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
The banging of the chilled pie crust. Mm. So when I worked at Baked, there was a woman I worked with who always did that. But the rest of us were taking out the dough and resting it until it had warmed up enough that we could just roll it out. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about banging versus waiting.
Mm-hmm. I think with banging, you have a little bit more control. Mm-hmm. So after we make the pie dough, we let it chill in the fridge for at least 2 hours. So it gets to be like super chilled, just like the butter was when you originally took it out to cut it into the dough. And so when you take it out and it's in its little disc, it would be really hard for you to just like start rolling it out to flatten it right away. And so we take our rolling pin and we bang it left to right and then turn it and bang it again. And what this does is it begins to bring the dough up to temperature a little bit, so like up to room temperature so that it's easier to work with. And it also begins the flattening process so that you're not, I think like anything to make the rollout process a little bit more straightforward and filled with direction is better. And so, you know, we're flattening it so then we can easily start to roll out just the edges and then we can roll out from the center until we're done. And I think the banging just like instead of like setting, I think it would be a lot harder for us to control our like the bakers all like having the dough sitting out and getting to the perfect temperature. But like if we're just banging it, it's like we're just doing it.
Well, it makes perfect sense for a commercial kit, you know, for a bakery. But also I'm just thinking about at home, I want to start banging and stuff.
It's also like a really fun way to let out some aggression. And there's just like never been a time more important for that.
Yeah, right? Struck with the cornmeal in the in some of the fillings. Mm-hmm. I love that, and I want to know about that. Like in the salted maple, which I like to think of as like this weird love child of 4 and 20.
And that's what I talked about. It's an homage to that.
Yeah, I love that.
Thank you. Yeah. So the cornmeal. So cornmeal is the traditional ingredient in chess pie.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and so that's like the sort of like thickener in chess pie. So that's kind of why I originally started to use it. But we also work with this great farm in Michigan called Hampshire Farms in Kingston. And we use their buckwheat flour, their rye flour, their beans, and their cornmeal. And their cornmeal is just the most delicious cornmeal I've ever had. It's like really soft, but also like large, you know, like big chunks.
Mm-hmm. Coarse.
Coarse,
I like big chunks, but.
Yeah, but it's like coarse, but it's not because it's soft.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know. It's kind of unfortunate that like not everyone who makes the cookbook can get it.
Yeah.
I like wanted to do like a promotion where I like sent everyone a bag of it. So in like the chess pies, like most of our recipes that are not fruit pies are like rooted in chess pie, mm-hmm. sort of like the style to kind of get us where we need to go. And so cornmeal acts as like, you know, the thing that kind of like brings everything together. But then we use it in a lot of other recipes just for flavor. You mm-hmm. know, like you'll see it in our scones, you'll see it in a pie dough in the mm-hmm. book. I just love cornmeal yeah. and I want it all the time.
Yum. A shout out to like big cookies made with a quarter cup scoop.
Mm.
I always use a quarter cup scoop. And people are like, why is the cookie so big? I love a big cookie. But I was struck with, I think do what you guys do is refrigerate for, you know, if I have time. It could be 48 hours for some cookies, but if I don't, a day.
Mm-hmm.
But I always bake them cold. Like, I usually scoop, then refrigerate, and then bake like that. But mm-hmm. you're having the dough come back to room temp mm-hmm. before you scoop, till you say, I think, quite soft. Talk to me about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's the first time I've ever thought about that.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
When I worked at Baked, we had the soft dough that we always scooped mm-hmm. and then put that into the refrigerator. So I think that's probably why I do it.
Mm-hmm. I think a part of it is that I think like originally when I read recipes about scooping, like maybe like the infamous chocolate chip recipe mm. from the New York Times
yeah.
way long ago.
Yes.
I think that dough was chilled and then scooped and then baked immediately from scooping. And I think part of it is like just storage in the fridge. Mm-hmm. Like it's easier
right,
to store like a pack of dough. But also I think like a lot of our doughs, they just like, it's harder to scoop them when they're soft. And so like a lot of times when you're mixing cookie dough and you're using room temperature butter, if that's like what you happen to be doing, then by the time it's mixed, that butter is like starting to almost get too warm.
Mm-hmm.
And so to scoop it at that time can like be a mess, but also is like a little bit dangerous. Not like health-wise, but I just mean like you don't want the cookie to be melting and whatever.
Yeah.
And so when we take it out of the fridge, we can again like control the temperature at which we scoop it, which feels like more ideal to us.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Finally, I love that your granola calls for olive oil and coconut oil, because mine does. My recipe for granola does too. And
cool.
I love that combo. And I think that is it. And I just want to say what Carrie says every time, which is, Lisa, you are like so completely the bomb.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So are you.
That's it for our show. Thank you to Jesse Sheehan for guest hosting and to Lisa Lidwinski for visiting all the way from Detroit. If you find yourself in Detroit, make sure to stop by Sister Pie for a slice and tell them you're part of the Bomb Squad. Both Jesse and Lisa have fantastic cookbooks out right now. Jesse's Vintage Baker and Lisa's Sister Pie. They would make a perfect holiday gift for any baker babes or cookbook collectors in your life. Also, we have one last stop on our Future of Food tour this year. It's Seattle on December 1st. We'll be at our happy place, Book Larder. Visit cherrybomb.com or booklarder.com for tickets. We would love to see you there. Let's thank our sponsors, Bob's Red Mill, Vital Farms Pasture-Raised Eggs, and Le Cordon Bleu Culinary School for supporting Radio Cherry Bomb. And thank you to our associate producer, Jess Seidman, and to the band Tra La La for our theme song. This episode was recorded at The Wing in Dumbo. For more information, go to the-wing.com. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.
Radio Cherry Bomb is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Have you heard? It's party time. Monday, December 3rd is Winter in the Garden, Heritage Radio Network's second annual year-end gala at the Brooklyn Botanic Gardens Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe. Join HRN staff, hosts, members, and some very talented chefs and bartenders for a delicious evening that will kick off the holiday season and support our end-of-year fundraising drive. The evening will begin with a VIP hour, complete with bubbles and oysters. Then, all of our guests will work their way around two spacious rooms filled with food stations and bars, sampling fare from some of our favorite chefs. Sip on your choice of cocktails, beer, wine, sake, and cider while bidding on exclusive silent auction items. 2019 is our 10th anniversary. So, whether you've been a member since Roberta's first opened, or if you just discovered your new favorite food podcast, please consider supporting us with a ticket purchase so we can start the year on solid ground. We'd love to see you at the Garden. So join us on December 3rd. For more information and to purchase tickets, go to heritageradionetwork.org/gala.